You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 8th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, I'll be joined by Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled to discuss the day's top stories, including the latest failure to rescue an American hostage from imprisonment in the Middle East, the collapse of the coalition governing Israel, and Uruguay's hospitality to Guantanamo Bay alumni. We'll also take a look at one of the stories in new Monocle publication, The Forecast. Later in the show, we'll hear from our man in Madrid, meet our new neighbours in Tokyo, and
I've just been informed that someone has been killed. Would you like to comment on this?
Justice served.
Justice served. So you're saying you had something to do with this?
Yes. I killed him.
We'll take a look ahead to the Singapore Film Festival and review the latest art openings. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. But ahead of a characteristically action-packed hour, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
The United Nations has launched its biggest ever appeal for aid. It says it needs almost $16.5 billion in 2015. Almost half of that total is earmarked for refugees from the civil war in Syria. The UN's humanitarian chief has said the organization is facing need at an unprecedented level. It's claimed 78 million people in more than 20 countries could need UN aid next year. The leader of the Church of England has said it's shocking that so many people in Britain are reliant on charities to feed themselves. A new report says that almost a million people are now using food banks, seven times more than 4 years ago. It says changes to the welfare benefits system are at least partly to blame. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, admits poverty in many other countries is far worse, but says he's been stunned to see such need in Britain.
It's how shocking it is to find this happening here. I've seen much worse very recently, and will do over the next couple of weeks when I'm travelling, but it's finding it here is it just it's in the wrong place. We don't do that in this country, and we need to stop.
A court in China has sentenced eight people to death over two large-scale attacks in Xinjiang province earlier this year. In the first, a group armed with knives and explosives killed three people and injured dozens more in an attack near a railway station. A week later, a car and bomb attack on a market killed 39 and injured almost 100 people. Authorities in the Indian capital Delhi have banned the taxi booking service Uber after a driver allegedly raped a passenger. The woman used Uber's smartphone app to book a taxi, but says she was driven to a secluded area and raped. The driver has been remanded in custody. In a separate case, a court in the Netherlands has upheld a government-imposed ban on Uber. It says the use of unlicensed drivers is against Dutch law. Hubert Andela is from the organization which represents taxi drivers in the country.
Uber is not allowed to work with people who are not licensed as a taxi driver. And of course that was already clear, but it didn't stop Uber from doing it. Now the court said, fined according to law, and the fine is as it should be.
A judge in South Africa has thrown out a high-profile case against a British businessman who was accused of hiring hitmen to murder his wife on their honeymoon. The judge said that the case against Shirin Dewani was so weak there was no prospect of a conviction. He was extradited to South Africa after a lengthy legal battle. The family of the victim, Annie Dewani, have said they have been failed by the country's legal system. Her sister, Ami Denbord, spoke outside the court in Cape Town.
We waited patiently for 4 years to hear what really happened to Annie and to hear the full story of what happened to our dearest little sister. And the hope of actually finding that out has kept us as a family going. Unfortunately, we believe that this right has now been taken away from us.
The last pieces of wreckage from the loss of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine are now on the way to the Netherlands. More than two-thirds of those on the flight were Dutch. The last parts of the plane had been stuck in eastern Ukraine in an area where outside access was impossible. The wreckage will now be reassembled by investigators in the Netherlands. Annika Bervens is from the Dutch Safety Board.
The first convoy is to be expected at the airbase of Geelse Rijen in the Netherlands in the course of this week. Relatives of the victims will be present when the first convoy arrives. Once the wreckage has arrived, the Dutch Safety Board will start the investigation of the wreckage and the preparation of the reconstruction of a part of the airplane.
The EU's foreign policy chief has been to Turkey, telling the government there to do more to support the campaign against Islamic State militants in Syria. Federica Mogherini says Turkey must step up its efforts to stop the flow of foreign fighters over the border. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Buenos Aires
to Zurich
to Hong Kong
to Toronto
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, which is 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, I have Kathleen Burke, Professor Emerita of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and Daniela Pelled, Editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. We're going to start with this past weekend's attempt to rescue the American photojournalist Luke Summers from his kidnappers in Yemen. A raid by US Special Forces failed and Summers was killed alongside South African hostage Pierre Corky, who was apparently due for release under a deal done with his captors, but of whose presence US intelligence were unaware. The US has announced that despite this third failed rescue of an American hostage in the last 6 months, they will not review their policy on such situations. Kathleen, I'll ask you first, is there anything wrong with the way the US confronts these situations? Have they, I mean, any such operation is obviously going to be difficult and hazardous, etc., etc. Have they just been unlucky three times in a row?
Well, it is a bit alarming, is it not? I hadn't quite counted them up, in fact, till this it emerged today when one did. The thing is, the Americans have always placed a very high priority on getting Americans out of difficulties. The other things will be sacrificed in order to do this, and therefore, I suspect that there's not really much discussion in the appropriate departments about whether this should be done, but just how it should be done. I cannot imagine... Forgive me. I cannot imagine in the Pentagon or in areas of the White House saying, well, I know he's American, but we'll just have to let him go. What can they do? The intelligence doesn't seem to be up to snuff. If they didn't even know there was a second hostage. It's hard to know. Things aren't going to change in that. The policy is not going to change. But what can you say? Must do better?
Daniela, it's a situation that illustrates very clearly the difference between US attitudes to this and the attitudes of some other countries and some other organizations, in that $200,000 had been raised for the South African hostage and it was anticipated this would be passed to his kidnappers and he would be released imminently. The problem with giving money to hostage takers is so obvious that it doesn't need enumeration. But is there something basically admirable about America's attitude, that it goes and gets its people's back?
Well, admirable or not, I mean, there's certainly cross, you know, the House is united in this, the idea that you don't pay ransoms for hostages. So that's not going to change. I mean, if you look at it from the other point of view, if this had gone well, imagine, you know, the glory.
That, indeed.
That it would have been, imagine that the camera webcam footage, you know, imagine, it would have been fantastic. America has had a series of very unfortunate and shaming experiences in the Middle East recently. So that could have been, had it worked, you know, something that would have wiped all that out. All these things are admirable in the abstract. Yes, it's admirable to never negotiate with terrorists. It's admirable to never play hostages, you know, for hostages. It's admirable to not. But in reality, you have to make compromises. In reality, it's not quite so simple. The thing is, this isn't an electioneering or a great campaigning issue, because it's not going to affect the lives of very many Americans who are going to be directly involved in this sort of hostage situations.
I mean, the specific situation is interesting as well. And this took place in Yemen, where I guess prior to 2001, people had got, I mean, it was almost part of the tourist experience getting kidnapped in Yemen. You would sort of get hauled off to a cave in the ranges for a few days, sort of fed very well, and then upon the delivery of the ransom, be presented with a ceremonial sword and sent home with an amusing story to tell. But is it now the case that the other difficulty for Americans, and I'll put this to you, Kathleen, that Americans, because they're American, are more vulnerable as hostages because they're American and therefore more prized?
Well, I think Americans certainly are, for all sorts of reasons. Trophy, I think, is the word we're looking for. The British are not far behind. Yemen is interesting because, for example, if you look at Guantanamo, by far the largest number of men still being held there are from the Yemen. Yemen has been a difficulty for anti-Islamists or anti-Qaeda, one might say, for quite a long time, in fact. This was an unexpectedly ferocious reaction, I think. They don't always shoot the hostages when attacked. And in this case, it seems to have been almost, not precisely pre-planned, but it seemed to have been assumed within their group, as far as one can tell from the reports, that this is what would happen. I think the Americans have to take that more into account, that if they're going to do it, there has to be more than seeing the hostages. There has to be, I don't know, more daring do, shall we say, taking out more surrounding areas. I don't know. But it's dangerous, and it's possibly more dangerous than saying we'd better leave them there for a while.
The problem is there does seem to be a certain amount of derring do in this latest operation, and quite a lot of civilians were reportedly killed, including a 10-year-old boy. And I have some sympathy with the American administration on this, because doing nothing isn't always an option. There were questions, all of the hostages held by ISIS was, why did America not do more for them? Why didn't they try harder? The families have had all kinds of criticism, and that's played very, very badly with the American public. And I agree, there's this idea, we'll never leave one of our citizens behind. But certainly in Israel, in the Israeli army, there's also this philosophy of never leaving a soldier behind. And as we've seen in innumerable wars in Gaza recently, that's not quite so simple, and it can have really, really disastrous consequences.
I also wonder whether the nature of modern media, social media in particular, has made hostage taking a more potent weapon, because now that you have a hostage, or when you have a hostage now, you don't need to rely on newspapers and television news to mediate that news to the rest of the planet. You can run your own production, as ISIS have. I mean, is this something we're going to have to get used to happening more often?
Well, we had to get used to televising war, didn't we?
Indeed.
That was one of the turning points of the Vietnam War, and one reason American anti-war ideas surged up, because on the 6 o'clock news you saw body bags, and that had never happened before. I think you've made an extremely important point, that although social media doesn't necessarily reach everyone, certainly within the age group that's of increasing importance, not to mention the young, it's the natural thing to do. And one real strength of IS, as well as Al-Qaeda and so forth, is their command of social media. The ability to propagandize, the ability to spread not only fear, but also apprehension, and the ability to taunt, I think is extremely important. Yes, it's transforming warfare, because it's using this, in a sense, soft power in support of hard military power.
Daniela, you mentioned Israel there, which is where we will look now, where the Knesset has today voted to dissolve itself to permit early elections to be held on March 17th. The vote follows last week's sacking by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of his justice and finance ministers, and the not unexpected collapse of his querulous coalition. Tzipi Livni, who is the outgoing Minister of Justice, says this is all the result of a Prime Minister who, as she puts it, is afraid of his own ministers. Is she right?
I think she has a very good point.
It's probably the first thing anyone's ever said that's made me sort of sympathetic towards Benjamin Netanyahu, because looking around that cabinet table,
this is it. This is it. You know, even during the Gaza War, you're faced with a situation where Netanyahu is kind of on the moderate side of his cabinet. Yeah, these are really uncalled for, unnecessary, pointless, probably potentially disastrous elections. And I've covered a succession of Israeli elections, and this one fills me with the most amount of dread so far. The potential is if the centre-left, and I use centre very loosely, if they form a coalition, there is a possibility that the next government of Israel might not be led by Netanyahu, and there might be a more pro-peace, or at least pro-interested in negotiations, government. But equally, and probably more likely, is a right-wing government so hardline that it will indeed make the current one look like a moderate set of bunnies.
That's an appealing prospect. Kathleen, do you see any grounds for optimism here at all?
Not a lot. I mean, what Israel reminds me is nothing so much as the Weimar Republic, of course, which had the same kaleidoscopic group of parties where it merged and unmerged and sparkles and so forth, and looked what happened to it. I don't say that Israel is about to have a new Hitler in that sense, which is possibly an analogy one that might not have made. But the point is that the instability of Israeli politics, at least to the outside. Obviously, there's a strong core that holds Israel together, at least the Jewish part of Israel together. But nevertheless, there's nothing that dominates. And in order to have a block of parties, you have to have something in common. And one gets the impression, although I may be wrong, that these parties have more in opposition than they do have in common. And it will be very difficult to put together any sort of coalition. But I very much agree with Daniela. It's more likely that it's going to be a hard line right-wing coalition than a more liberal one.
I think the interesting thing is perhaps many outside observers would think that Israeli politics would be dominated by issues with the Palestinians, but they're really not, and certainly not this election. I mean, one of the uniting issues that people will be campaigning about is social justice, the economy, those kinds of issues. There was certainly very much a presence in the last elections. But this time around, I mean, what Jewish Israelis are more outraged about are things like the price of cottage cheese and the price of chocolate desserts and the price of general living in Israel, which is extraordinarily expensive.
As always, it's the economy, commerce, stupid, as James Carville famously told Bill Clinton.
Well, could I ask then, is this the first case in a long time where the question of Palestinians and peace isn't a dominant element?
I have to say, sadly, I think the last election... that was certainly the case. But perhaps that misfired. I mean, the Labour Party campaigned specifically on the issue of social justice and the economy and really just tried to not mention the war, stupid. And perhaps that backfired because they did extraordinarily badly, and that the more left-wing Zionist party, Meretz, did rather better. Now, this time round, possibly the emerging voice is somebody who, a former minister, who not only does not have a party, but doesn't have any potential members to fill this potential party, doesn't have a platform for the party, but is already expected to get at least 10 seats in the Knesset. And this is the former minister, Moshe Kahlon. Now, he is a Likudnik who basically, I don't want to simplify this too much, brought down the price of mobile phones for Israelis, which makes him very, very popular. But a politician that actually delivered something tangible. Now, who knows what he thinks about the peace process? All indications he's given so far is that he's pretty right-wing, but, you know, perhaps malleable, perhaps pragmatic. But that kind of shows the situation that we're in, where this relative newcomer without a party, without a platform, without any following, is going to be the potential kingmaker.
Well, I suspect that over the next 3.5 months, we may have one or two opportunities to return to the subject of Israel's election. So on that thought, we will head to Uruguay, where outgoing President Jose Mujica has cultivated something of a reputation for both political radicalism and personal eccentricity, legalising gay marriage and marijuana while living on a modest farm, driving an elderly VW Beetle and dressing like he's just come in from the garden. Even by those standards, however, Uruguay's decision to take in 6 prisoners from the American camp at Guantanamo Bay is striking. The 4 Syrians, 1 Tunisian and 1 Palestinian, have been held in Cuba since 2002 and never charged. They will arrive in Uruguay as free men. Kathleen, 58% of Uruguayans apparently are not altogether enthused about having these 6 gentlemen as neighbours. Why has President Mujica done this?
Well, for one thing, because he himself spent 10 years in prison.
Indeed.
In a sense, a political prisoner, and he obviously has some deep sympathy. Secondly, of course, an awful lot of people don't necessarily agree with the American idea that these people ought to be, deserve to be, must be kept in prison. He said that when President Obama said, gosh, will anyone please help me with these chaps? President Mujica said, yes, I will. So in that sense, I suppose one reason Uruguayans are apprehensive is because if these are possible terrorists, that might be something difficult in Uruguay.
Well, I think the argument would be that even if they were sort of downy innocents when apprehended 12 years ago, they might have been... I mean, I'd be pretty angry at this point, is what I'm saying. You can kind of see the reasoning. What I can't quite figure out is whether President Mujica is actually having a dig at America here. He's called their treatment an atrocious kidnapping, or whether he's actually doing them a favor, because America's also gone out of their way to say they're incredibly grateful to Uruguay for taking these men.
Yeah. Of course, just one thing to add to that is to remember, of course, that he's now going out of office. He's finished his final term, so any difficulties that come up will be his successor's problem, not his.
Yeah, I think this is like a final quirk of a particularly quirky leader. It's from anything I've read about it, it's not clear that Uruguay is actually getting anything out of this personally. Although, as we all remember from WikiLeaks, the Americans were desperate to make deals with numerous countries around the world if they would only take a few of the people from Guantanamo.
So far, it's only Uruguay. I think El Salvador's taken a couple. There's 136 men still in Guantanamo Bay who can't be transferred to their home countries because their home countries are substantially less desirable places to live than a prison camp in Cuba. Famously, it's coming towards the end of Barack Obama's presidency. One of the things he said he would do when he was running for president was close Guantanamo Bay. Why hasn't that happened?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Congress won't let him. Secondly, where are you going to put them in the United States? Because there's a strong fear that if they are in the U.S., they will be the focus of terrorist attacks to try to either do. They will do it, or others will come and help them do it, or they'll be hostage and then they'll be burst out or whatever. And so Obama cannot keep them in America outside of Guantanamo. Short of putting them in a boat and turning them into boat people, there's not a lot he can do unless other countries will accept them.
There's probably a memo been floating around with that particular suggestion.
Well, there are 136 men still there who nobody wants and who they can't send home. I mean, is America now in the position where it just has to basically keep them there until they all die?
Well, this is not going to be Obama's problem for very much longer, but what are they supposed to do with them? It would be cheaper, really, for them to stay in America and secure. Because America will only release them to places where they will be secure as well. I mean, they won't be secure, i.e. they won't cause too much trouble. And they can't be sent back to...
Montana, for example.
This is ridiculous. I mean, this is a ridiculous state of bureaucracy. I mean, if America could get it down to double figures, perhaps, they'd be like on the search for a solution. But it's really intractable, really intractable.
I still think that would be a tough sell to the people of Montana. We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled. When we return, we will discuss Monocle's new publication, Forecast, and the current state of Kazakhstan. Do stay tuned.
The Cafe Pacific Experience is one of ease and exploration, introducing a contemporary Asian experience to international travel. By placing service at its core, Cafe Pacific evolves with its passengers, creating a home away from home in its lounges and aircraft. Having built its name on service and quality, Cafe Pacific has helped turn its Hong Kong home into a premier transport hub, making the airline one of the world's leading aviation brands. Find out how Cathay Pacific is flying into 2015 and get the view beyond the horizon in The Forecast, the brand new magazine from the editors and bureau of Monocle.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism, at Monocle 24 we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Kathleen Burke and Daniela Pelled. Now, on a newsstand near you now, resplendent in an iridescent salmon cover, is the latest publication from Monocle. The forecast is our new annual survey of the year ahead. Its datelines for this first edition include Oslo, Los Angeles, Abu Dhabi, Calgary, among many others. And for our consideration today, Kazakhstan, subject of a terrific feature by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Daniela, this Kazakhstan, it's the size of Europe. It's bigger than Europe, and the only thing anyone knows about it is Borat. How has that happened?
I think you could rephrase it. The only thing that anyone knows in the UK and US is
I'm sure people
Borat.
In Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan
know more
is
about
quite
it.
A big player in Central Asia on the scene. It's Kazakhstan. It's enormous. There aren't many people who live there comparatively, but it's done quite well in the post. Soviet era. I mean, let's say not in the field of human rights particularly, but in economy and in its own development. It's been pursuing a sort of multi-vector foreign policy that has allowed it to build relations with the West, the Arab world, and Russia.
It is, of course, due to become on January 1st part of Vladimir Putin's Eurasian Economic Union. It will join Belarus, Armenia, and Kazakhstan. Kathleen, is this a serious thing, the EEU, or is this Putin's sort of Greater Russia fantasy made bureaucratic flesh?
Well, I think it's two, isn't it? I mean, obviously, Putin's life drive now is to reconstruct an empire, whether you call it Russia or whether you call it the Soviet Union, remembering he said the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century was the ending of the Soviet Union. Now, he's got two choices. He can either invade them and take them over, or he can lure them into a web. And
which is what he was trying to do with Ukraine, of course.
Yes, well, there we are on that one. the idea of a customs union, okay, you don't want them to go to the customs union in the West, so therefore you provide your own customs union, so they'll think things are just as well. One gathers, in fact, reports started coming out about a month ago, 2 months ago, that Kazakhstan was getting a bit nervous about throwing in its economic lot with Russia. Of course, what can they do about it now? On the other hand, it's interesting that those Kazakhstani who actually have rubles are having a great time right now with the death-defying plunge of the ruble, which has gone on. They're taking their rubles and buying jillions in Siberia. So they can't get out of it now. If they try to get out of it now, Putin will do unspeakable things.
Steve's piece makes the point, Daniela, that Kazakhstan is somewhat invested in the survival of one man. This is President Nazarbayev, who has been president as long as Kazakhstan has existed. Steve also makes the point that there's no foundation myth to Kazakhstan. There was no revolution. There was no civil war. It sort of became independent by accident. It's building this bizarre new capital, Astana, which basically does look like Abu Dhabi on ice. Might Putin reason that, you know, he sort of helped himself to a large chunk of Ukraine and nobody came to his rescue? He could do what he liked with Kazakhstan, couldn't he?
Well, I think there has been a bit of sort of mild fight back, because the idea of the economic union is that, Nazarbayev has very strenuously resisted any idea that it would be sort of a supranational political body with a shared foreign policy. I think Kazakhstan has very much tried to... As I said,
Putin hilariously was talking about a shared military infrastructure as well. I can imagine how he sees that panning out.
Yeah, sharing. Rather like toddlers do sharing, perhaps. No, exactly. I mean, this is a sensitive issue. I mean, there's a very, very significant... ethnic Russian minority in Kazakhstan, and some more nationalist Russian politicians were talking about how the north of Kazakhstan was next in their sight. So I don't think, I mean...
Putin himself said that most Kazakhs favour closer ties with Russia.
Yes, exactly. I'm not sure. I'm not really not sure about that. Economic ties, I think a lot of people are making the case for, although they are worried that it will favour, and it will favour Russia more than it will favour it will favour them. But Kazakhstan is still trying to play this diplomatic game of being seen as the party that can do business with the East and the West, to build its ties with China as Russia becomes more and more of a liability. You know, their attitude over Ukraine, you know, they sort of urged responsible action over Crimea, and then they went to Poroshenko's inauguration. They're trying to stay in the middle. That's been their policy previously, and now it's getting a bit more difficult because Russia is getting more and more volatile.
That feature, among much else, in the forecast on a newsstand near you. We will have to leave it there for the moment. Daniela Peled, Kathleen Burke, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Loads coming up in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll be hearing from our man in Madrid and getting a taste of what's in show at the Singapore Film Festival, among much else. But ahead of all that, Paul Osborne is back with the headlines.
The United Nations has launched its biggest ever appeal for aid. It says it'll need nearly $16.5 billion in 2015. Almost half of that total has been earmarked for refugees from the civil war in Syria. The UN's humanitarian chief has said the organisation faces an unprecedented level of need. In the UK, a parliamentary report has revealed that nearly a million people are now reliant on food banks, seven times more than 4 years ago. The report says that changes to Britain's welfare system are at least partly to blame. A court in China has sentenced eight people to death over two large-scale attacks in Xinjiang province earlier this year. In the first, a group armed with knives and explosives killed three people at a railway station. A week later, an attack at a market killed 39. And authorities in the Indian capital Delhi have banned the taxi booking service Uber after a driver allegedly raped a passenger. The woman says she was driven to a secluded area and attacked. The driver has been remanded in custody. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, 21:33, near enough in Moscow. That's 18:33 here in London, 16:33 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Madrid, where I'm joined by Liam Aldous. Liam, welcome to the show. First of all, a subject we've talked about a few times before, the sudden eruption in Spanish politics of a new political force, Podemos. Is the honeymoon over?
Well, depends. I guess it depends on who you ask. It's not looking. They've basically declined the upward trend. So that a new poll has come out showing that Podemos and its leader Pablo Iglesias, with his very symbolic ponytail, is actually their poll results have plateaued a bit. So it's showing that the PSOE, which are the socialists, who's the opposition leader, Pedro Sanchez, we interviewed in the current issue of Monocle, is actually sitting at 27.7%. Podemos is just behind them as the second most voted force at 25%, and the current government is around 20%. So it's not looking good for the right side of Spanish politics, but Podemos is still up there, but there's been a few controversies recently, especially when they've been put on the spot and asked to provide a bit of policy detail, and people are probably reassessing their voter intention.
Well, this is very often the case with populist insurgencies, as we've seen here in the UK with UKIP, when you sort of put most of their actual politicians and activists under the spotlight and ask them any sensible questions, the wheels tend to come off fairly rapidly. A lot of reports are suggesting that this dip in the polls for Podemos is due to one particularly disastrous television interview. How bad can it have been?
Yeah, it's true. I wouldn't say it was disastrous. I watched it. It just was very mediocre and very... It just Pablo Iglesias didn't provide the answers to the questions, basically, which is basically what a lot of typical Spanish politicians do. So he didn't really distinguish himself there. And since then, they've released a few policy documents, particularly an economic policy document, which has really toned down some of their very outlandish claims and proposals, one of which was to provide a government-subsidized universal wage. And that's just been changed to now they just want to provide subsidies to lower-income people. So we'll probably see a bit of this in the lead-up to the election, which will be the end of next year. They will start toning down a lot of these controversial claims and realigning them to hopefully some more rational policies.
Well, elsewhere in Spanish politics, it's either a very bad time to be a health minister or a good time. I can't quite figure out which, because if you are a health minister without currently a job as a health minister, there's a couple of vacancies.
Exactly. If you're looking for a job, it's probably a good time. We've lost, in Madrid, we've lost two health ministers. We lost the national health minister, who has basically been embroiled in a very huge corruption scandal with a whole lot of other politicians. Her husband actually has been charged. I'm talking about Ana Mato from the current government. Her husband was charged with receiving a lot of kickbacks and bribes to hook up contracts to certain companies. And she actually claimed that she didn't know anything about it. And when they asked her whether she noticed the Jaguar sitting in her driveway, which was linked to this corruption network, she said she'd never seen the Jaguar before. And this was a constant joke. This was going on for years. And finally, she was indicted a couple of weeks ago in the official investigation. And Rajoy had no choice but to ask her to resign. And he's been protecting her this whole time. I think it was the final straw. So she's gone. And also Javier Rodriguez, the Madrid health minister, who was very controversial during our Ebola crisis when we had a nurse who got infected, and he basically tried to shift the blame onto the nurse, and he said some very probably inappropriate and unfortunate things, such as you don't need a master's degree to know how to put a suit on, and some people just have a better capacity to follow instructions than others, and basically just criminalize the nurse rather than try to address the problem. So he was... He's been actually sacked after his handling of that crisis.
And finally, Liam, in a story straight out of the What Could Possibly Go Wrong file, a somewhat excitable gentleman has decided to protest against something or other by leaping into the lion's enclosure at Barcelona Zoo with what I think we can describe as predictable consequences.
Yeah, and we still don't know what exactly he was trying to protest, but he definitely got some attention. He jumped into the lion enclosure, and there's footage of it, actually. He gets attacked by two lionesses luckily the authorities were very quick, and he was attacked by a lioness, fell into the ditch separating the visitors and the lions, and they were pouring or squirting hoses directly on the lions, and the lions backed off and they got him out of there, but he's still in a critical condition. And he's not just he actually probably is a bit of a crazy lunatic, but this isn't the first time he's done something like this. He has been protesting all this year. He actually unveiled an anti-abortion protest with a few swastikas on the famous Gaudi building, La Pedrera, just two weeks ago. And the scariest thing of this whole drama of this guy's record, he's a local policeman. He's actually from a small town. He's actually a policeman who's officially on leave, so... That's a very worrying piece of information.
Yeah, I think I'm detecting the inverted commas around on leave there. We have no idea what his particular thing is here. He didn't sort of think to leave a manifesto before he hurled himself into the lion's enclosure?
No, but he did actually try to enter the Catalonian parliament just a few weeks ago as well with a... he was protesting corruption. He's protested a lot of different things. He was also protesting the independence movement. So I think he just picks a claim and tries to get attention. I just don't think... he jumped into a lion's cage, Andrew. I don't think he's quite right in the head.
Entirely possible, I suspect. Liam Aldous, Monocle's man in Madrid, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we go and meet one of the neighbours of Monocle's new Tokyo bureau.
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes
covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to me, Andrew Muller, nearly 1840 here in London. Now, in October, Monocle's Tokyo Bureau moved to the Tomagaya neighbourhood. It's a charming spot. It's home to a mix of traditional and new businesses, including a tatami mat maker and a traditional luthier, which is somebody who does things with lutes and mandolins and other stringed instruments. This week, we take a stroll down the street to meet some of our neighbours. We start our series visiting Yuroriki, a fish shop on Kamiyama Street, where the proprietor, Yasushisa Suzuki, explains why his family-run business started serving lunch nearly three decades ago.
My name is Yasuhisa Suzuki, fourth generation head of Uoriki. We have been selling fresh fish and seafood for more than a century now. I'm the fourth generation in my family to run the business. We started the restaurant side of our business in 1986, and it's been going for almost 30 years.
The family's fish shop hasn't always been on Kamiyama Street. It started off in Omori on Tokyo's south side and moved to a more central location in Aoyama. But the shop was destroyed in firebombing during the Second World War. After the war, the shop opened in its current location on a street that's a short walk to Shibuya, Tokyo's youth fashion district.
Originally, we started the restaurant with a counter and six or seven seats, but the neighborhood changed. The number of residents decreased and businesses increased, so we expanded the restaurant. Today, we have a counter on the ground floor and tables on the upper floor. We are a fish shop that changed with the times. I was a student back in the late 80s. The bubble economy soon popped and everyone disappeared. That was the reality. But then subsidiaries of public broadcaster NHK started moving into this area, and more businesses started opening offices as families were moving out. The number of people who were coming to buy fish at the shop decreased, so my parents came up with the idea of serving fish here, and that's how we created the business we have today.
At lunchtime, customers enter the shop and choose from a selection of meals handwritten on styrofoam slats. The house speciality is mackerel stewed in miso, and the rice and soup are all you can eat. But don't take too much. If you can't finish your rice, you pay a fine of 500 yen. It's a throwback to a time when Japan was a poor country suffering from food shortages, and the mindset of mottainai, or wastefulness, was prevalent.
I pick up fish every morning at Tsukiji Fish Market. I always try to source tasty fish. I have tasted everything we sell in the shop daily, and I know the taste and where the fish is from, so I can answer any question and I'm happy to help. I have an impression that people might think they know about the fish, but there are a lot of different things about them actually, so you should ask. For instance, the market for tuna has changed a lot. Recently, farm tuna has been a hot topic in the back news, and there's more being sold at Tsukiji Fish Market. When farm tuna first appeared there, I didn't know much about it. I sampled it a few times and found it tasty. For example, the price of tuna that's caught offshore tends to shoot up when the sea is rough. So I also serve farm tuna here. We have seen a number of stylish shops move into this area of Tomigaya and Kamiyama over the past decade. That's my impression. In the past, it was different. People who used to live here 10 years ago will tell you how much it has changed. Those who come back are often surprised by what they see. This area has changed as much as the Shibuya Station area, now being redeveloped. There are many places around here serving wine. It wasn't like this 10 years ago.
It was Kenji Hall meeting Monocle's neighbours in Tokyo. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, the Singapore International Film Festival is underway right now until December 14th. It's the 25th edition of the festival this year, and it's showcasing 147 films from 50 countries. Monocle's Jason Lee now speaks to some of the people pushing boundaries through cinema.
Well, the festival has two roles. One is education and one is entertainment.
Yuni Hadi is the executive director of the Singapore International Film Festival. We're at a cafe right by her office, talking about the state of Singapore film and the role the festival plays.
So to fulfill those roles, we have both, of course, the screenings and the workshops, but also we have educational platforms like the Youth Jury program and also the Southeast Asian Film Labs. So these two programs are really where the heart of the festival is, which is to develop young talents, and in particular in Southeast Asia and in Singapore. So we're spending a lot of our time to make sure that this area develops in the future.
I guess films reflect the societies from which they come. And do you think this Singapore cinema is relevant outside Singapore's borders?
Well, I think the success of the film Ilo Ilo has shown that a story from Singapore can really travel and reach very far. And Ilo Ilo was very sincere. I didn't try to have certain formulas to make it work. So you never know how successful a film will be. But all we can do as creators and promoters of the film is to really sell the qualities we think that are honest. And I think that audiences these days are very smart and well-informed, and they have a lot of choice. So to really stand out is to really present our own selves and not try to copy like formulas.
We were talking before the taping, and you talked a little bit about how the Singapore Film Festival also pushes boundaries in terms of politics. And Singapore, of course, is somewhat notorious for, the government is notorious for its heavy-handed approach towards what is allowed and what isn't allowed. Can you talk about how you push the boundaries?
When we make selections, I think we are mainly looking at the creative and artistic quality of the films. We don't look at censorship at that point. I think for us, censorship is a process where we have to submit the films, and it's a due process for us. So I think as a festival, our role is to just create that platform to expose as many films as possible, as many genres as possible, and then the censorship is an administrative part of the festival.
Do you have a sense that the government is perhaps getting more and more lenient and more open to its alternative ways of thinking and approaches?
I was like, I don't know.
Are there films this year that might not have been approved 5 years ago?
I am sure that there are definitely boundaries because of the festival that have been broadened through the years, not only for the festival, but for Singapore films and films in general that are playing in Singapore. So we have definitely matured in that level for sure. Yeah.
Yuni says one Singaporean highlight this year is Ms. J Contemplates Her Choice, a psychological thriller directed by Jason Lai and starring Kit Chan, who plays the titular character. Ms. J's a stylish radio presenter who receives a strange call on air. The caller, it turns out, has held hostage a prostitute and a loan shark, and is forcing Ms. J to choose one of them to save. The caller says he'll kill the one she doesn't pick. If she refuses to make a decision, he'll kill them both. As the film progresses, secrets from the past come back to haunt Ms. J. I catch up with Jason and Kit, who tells me how her character's wardrobe, right down to the choice of lipstick she wears, reveals much about the character herself.
I always think that for a woman, how you choose to present yourself in public is, it's very indicative. Whether it is, do you wear stilettos or do you wear flat shoes? Yeah, Elle is looking at me. Whether you wear a dress or pantsuit, how you do your hair, what color lipstick you wear, they are very deliberate choices. And I think especially when it comes to a movie, which is very visual, I felt right at the beginning, like we discussed about hair color, haircut, yeah. I felt that Jo, you know, the fact is she had a very difficult past, obviously, but she wants to present a very strong and together look in the public. And I felt, if you look at her clothes and her hair, they're all very simple, but a red lipstick is the only thing that sort of had, well, other than color, it was a very strong character thing. And that, but then if you look at her at home, she's a lot softer because she can be herself in front of her sister and her child and her nephew. So it's really that, which a lot of modern women probably understand, that dichotomy, yeah. In some strange ways, you know, we try to live our life in a very simplistic way because I think that's the best way, just kind of live it simply and clearly. But whenever it comes to creative works, you're drawn to ambiguity and conflict, because I think for a lot of artist, whether you're a singer, dancer, or actor, it is that conflict that, and that's what makes our job so interesting. You get to live through your characters and kind of live a life that you probably wouldn't dare to in real life, or you shouldn't. And so that was what I was drawn to, the moral ambiguity. And also, she seemed, there were other things in the show, like Jason took the chance, I think he kind of examined a lot of other issues in Singaporean society, but he tackled it in a way that wasn't obvious. So I really liked that.
Talking about Singaporean society, this is a really Singaporean film. A lot of the scenes are set in locales that are not immediately obvious to people outside, but are immediately obvious to Singaporeans. Because a foreigner might watch the film and might think of Singapore and think of like skyscrapers and shopping malls, but none of that appear in the film. Was it a deliberate decision?
Yes, one of the things that I set out to do was to sort of give a very fresh look to this city, how to create a very familiar yet different look, you know, the HDBs, the Chinese temples, even old estates like Tiong Bahru. So that was one of the challenges that I set out to do, to sort of give a fresh look at our city.
今天我上节目接到一通怪电话，问我他应该是要一个大耳窿还是一个妓女。
I've just been informed that someone has been killed. Would you like to comment on this?
Justice served.
Justice served. So you're saying you had something to do with this?
Yes. I killed him.
Jason Lee at the Singapore International Film Festival, which runs until December 14th. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Coming up for the end of our show now, which means it's time for our daily arts reviews. And today we're talking visual arts with Ossian Ward, head of content of the Listen Gallery in London and a writer on contemporary art. Welcome to the show. You wanted to talk about a couple of exhibitions which are occurring in Oxford at the moment. The first of which is... This is a pretty high concept long throw by Jeremy Deller. He's attempting to link Andy Warhol and William Morris, which... Not that I count myself as necessarily a scholar of the works of either artist, but that does strike me as something of a stretch.
Yeah, I don't think it's so much the comparison. I mean, there are things to link them, but obviously you think about them being on different ends of the, let's say, the kind of social scale, you know, William Morris being obsessed with craft and detail and social justice for workers and things like that, and Warhol being on the luxury Hollywood obsessed kind of side of things. But
this was what I was worried. If a time machine was constructed to enable a face-to-face meeting between Warhol and Morris, my impression is that they probably wouldn't get on.
Well, Morris would probably do all the talking and Warhol would just sit there and afterwards go, gee, he's great. I mean, I think, you know, they were both massive workaholics. So they both worked their whole lives. They both were intrigued by the idea of bringing art to a wider public, let's say.
That they both became, I guess, kind of a self-contained personal brand as well, if you like.
Absolutely, yeah. William Morris had his shop on Oxford Street, and, you know, everyone knows about Warhol, especially now. I think some of the problems with the way the show's been put together is because Warhol's such a big brand that it's actually difficult to borrow any of his works of art without some huge cost to your insurance bill.
So if one goes to this exhibition, what does one actually see?
So it begins and ends quite lavishly with some textiles by both of them. So famously, you know, the tapestries produced by Morris obviously are familiar to all of us in terms of curtains and fabrics. But there's a wonderful Edward Burne Jones tapestry, a sort of grand 20-foot thing that greets you as you walk in. Then opposite you have Marilyn actually on a rug, produced by Andy Warhol. So, you know, there are gimmicks to it, if you like, but the idea is that one was obsessed with the medieval world and the other one was obsessed with Hollywood, and they were the kind of driving forces behind each of their careers. And then it sort of ends with quite a dramatic conflagration of the wallpapers of Morris. And actually, Andy Warhol produced a lot of wallpapers, albeit in a slightly less kind of domestic way. But so you have the wallpapers of William Morris juxtaposed with the camouflage paintings, late paintings of Andy Warhol. So the kind of, you know, the abstract patterns. And the neat trick that Della has pulled off is in the middle of the room is an enormous study for the wallpapers of William Morris, which begin with this kind of early state where they're very abstract, and they do indeed look exactly like camouflage paintings by Warhol. So there's a kind of visual trick there that works very well. But I think, you know, there's a lusciousness to both. And actually the competing sort of eyeball fizzing idea of having wallpapers on top of camouflage paintings and vice versa is actually great. I mean, it's visually striking and sort of knocks you out.
Do you get a sense, though, that there is any kind of, I guess, overlap in aesthetic or sensibility between the two men? Do the works look kind of congruent at all together?
Well, I think that's when you start slightly picking at straws, because flowers are obviously a big motif in both of them. Warhol's flowers are here in abundance, but they're treated very differently. They're treated as kind of objects, whereas Morris was obviously deeply interested in the natural world and was looking at these things as studies of reality and nature. But I think Warhol looks at them as he does anything else, like a soup can or a picture of a cow. But actually, you do see the technical details. So you see that Warhol was a technical artist, and he sketched these things out, and he looked at the photographs of the cow or the flowers that he got his motifs from, and he blew them up beautifully, and he knew exactly what he was doing. He was trained, obviously, as an illustrator, fashion illustrator. So there are similar ways in which they both worked to technical specifications, and of course there's the whole factory thing, which they have in common, albeit one working with craftsmen, the other one being more like a studio to hang out in.
Okay, well, that's the Love is Enough exhibition. That's at Modern Art Oxford until the 8th of March. Also, and reasonably briefly, you wanted to talk about the new William Blake Apprentice and Master at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford.
Yeah, well, I think it's good because it gives you the chronological history of how he began, similar ways to Warhol and Morris, as a budding and very talented draftsman. Towards the end, it sort of falls apart as a show because you then just get a blast of late Blake. The standout point is you do get to see a recreation of his studio in Lambeth, in this little room where he used to print his own work. You know, you have the press has been remade and the table and the furniture all sort of set out in this quite small room as he would have lived in Lambeth, which is wonderful to see. But then you sort of just get some greatest hits and some more prints, and by the end of it, you sort of lost the will to love
so
Blake.
So is it one of those things that it's possibly not worth going to Oxford to see, but if you're in Oxford anyway?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you like Blake, it's certainly worth seeing. If you're into printmaking, both shows will be of great interest to people who like prints and like decoration. But the Blake, you know, you only get blasts of his vision. It's not a sort of block, but it's not the blockbuster Blake exhibition, let's put it that way.
Okay, well, that's the William Blake exhibition, Apprentice and Master. That's at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. Ossian Ward, Head of Content at the Listen Gallery here in London, writer on contemporary art. Thank you very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. My thanks to our earlier special guests, Kathleen Burke and Daniela Peled. Today's show was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by David Pleasant and Alia Masood. Our studio manager was Joel Church. Up after the headlines at the top of the hour, you can hear Culture with Robert Bound. At 2200, I'll be back with Emma Nelson for this evening's edition of the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for this edition, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Tel Aviv. All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.